Welcome to Season 2 of Beyond the Wall, a Game of Thrones LCG podcast brought to you by Istral and Darknotch. We'd like to thank FFG and CardGameDB for their continued support, and the fantastic AGOT community as a whole for being the sole reason we do this cast. Thank you for letting us take you once again beyond the wall.
Welcome to another episode of Beyond the Wall. Today we'll have a quick intro. Well, maybe quick isn't exactly what we're going to have. Then we're going to talk about growing your meta with Lauren from Boston. We'll kind of have a quick tip of the week, a new segment for us. Then we're going to talk about the top 10 decks of all time. And finally, some closing comments.
Okay, John, it's episode 36, an insane parts of the world where Thanksgiving is celebrated about when you actually have a harvest. It's Thanksgiving.
Yes, which is great. So, I mean, 80% of the world's celebrating Thanksgiving.
Moving on. Yeah. Moving on.
80% of my world, Alex, is celebrating Thanksgiving.
Of your world. Very good. The big news this week, let's not dilly-dally, the game is out. The game is out almost everywhere, reports from all over the globe.
There were two of them at my local retailer. How exciting, I now own both.
Two copies. Yeah, but you know your local retailer is awful.
It is, it's really sad. I mean, how's the game ever going to get any promotion here with two copies? And they were like hidden in the back of all the 1.0 stuff they're still trying to get rid of.
I was pretty proud about having gone into my store and labeled all the cores that they had 36 for the local store.
Very cool. Which
was pretty good. And I was feeling pretty good about that, but then I posted that on our Facebook group, and then Andreas from Sweden posted his version of it with these much fancier, double-sided, classy-looking cards. And I feel one-upped.
Owned.
He credited me for the inspiration, but he definitely did a wonderful job on that.
That's great. I'm glad people are doing that because, I mean, anything that promotes the game, makes it bigger, is a good thing. And that really helped me when I did my meta.
I did mention 2.0 release all over the world. Not without hitches, though. Funny story, the Spanish language core sets apparently occasionally have Czech cards in them. Which what? Is interesting. Yeah, Alquimista, Aoria's brother-in-law, has a picture of his Spanish language core set with a Czech Aoria. And, you know, obviously strange. And I think there are two or three other cards that have been found that way.
If I had an alternate language card in one of my packs, I would think that's cool, actually.
Well, that's the thing. Actually, some of the Spaniards I was talking to, or specifically, they're buying English language core sets, and then they'll buy one Spanish language core set so they can trade cards with people at Stalic so that they can get versions in a whole bunch of different languages. And
yeah.
I'll give you a Spanish one, and you give me one of your Polish ones or whatever. But I guess if it already comes preloaded with Czech cards, you're in good shape.
You're one ahead.
Yeah. You're one ahead. Now, I will say that I've been requesting on the Facebook page and on some Card Game DB, there are a lot of inaugural Kingslayer or demo tournaments over the next week. Send us pictures of your inaugural tournament to the podcast email, beyondthewallpodcast@gmail.com. Check with your hosts and guests, obviously, that it's okay to take pictures. Nobody's going to get tagged in them. But I'd like to have an assortment of them for a nice little spread of the first week of the game kind of thing.
So, yeah, show us the swag you're giving out, too.
Yeah, exactly. So I got some news. We're going to have to keep it fairly short because we already have about an hour and 5 minutes of content, so the introduction's already eaten into time we don't have. Did you get a chance to see those Broken Egg Games tokens that I posted on our Facebook page?
Oh my god, I did. Okay, those are like, I like, I used to play poker a lot, so I like that click feel, the chips, and I actually borrowed the Saurus Rex Sean Emberley's chips one time just so I could flip them. But those broken eggs look like they're a good weight, and I could do chip tricks with those at the table. Oh, I'm going to get me some.
You're going to get you some? For me, the real hesitation is I'm not sure how the weight feels, like you said. If it feels metallic or if it feels heavy, I probably would like them. But if it feels a little plasticky or flimsy and it doesn't feel like what you expect a coin to look like, then yeah then I'm a little iffier. But they have actually contacted us, and they want us to talk about them. So who knows? If we're lucky, we might have a set to give away in a couple of weeks. I don't know.
If they send us a set so I can actually feel them, I would, you know, be a lot more excited. And then we could, like you said, Alex, give them away.
Yeah. What else this week? The just sort of official release stuff, the 2.0 playmats that we saw at Gen Con on sale are now officially on sale through the store, through the FFG store.
I was actually going to buy one. I was going to buy it from Team Covenant because they've been supporting the community so much. And I went on their site and it wasn't there. What's up with that, Team Covenant? Great power counters, great all this other stuff. You know, you got your subscription model, which I love because I can never get my chapter packs here in Ottawa. But where's my playmats?
Well, the playmats just went up for the site. I hope that they're available.
One day later, they don't have them yet.
I hope they will be available to retailers because
I'm sure.
FFG's shipping costs are pretty pricey if you go directly through their store. But I will say, I adore the Stark playmat, the Michael Cormack art of Ice. The red really, so nice. Really shows up on that one. The sort of direwolf fur that is on the border of the cards. You barely notice it on the cards, but on the border of that playmat, you really notice it looks nice. And I really like the colors on the Tyrell playmat. Those are my two favorites. Even though the Martell one is Megali art and looks phenomenal, I find the other two even better.
If you haven't seen those playmats, you can obviously check out pictures on FFG's website, or you can watch one of Rob St. John's streaming videos immediately. He had them all laid out. It was pretty nice.
Yeah, it's fantastic. There is an anecdote that I wanted to share this week. I was listening to another podcast, I know, blasphemy, but I obviously don't listen to this one. And in Banter Behind the Throne, the UK podcast, there was this push to get the UK national champion a flight to Worlds, and a whole bunch of community members came together, put together about £400 to help pay for the flight. And so Dave is going to Worlds. And I love this story. I love everything about it. I love the community getting together to support this. I love the way it was done. I love the fact that, you know, the podcasts are able to promote this kind of information about the community. This is great. This is fantastic.
Yeah, super awesome. I mean, these big tournament winners in Europe, they should be representing in Worlds and, you know, taking that championship home away from the American pop.
Three out of four at Worlds last year out of the top four were European.
For good reason, Alex.
Me sitting at five. I know. I just couldn't make it. Speaking of Worlds, though, we are getting awfully close to Worlds, and you've had some stuff going through the rumor mill.
I have. Do we really want to talk about that? I thought you didn't want to.
I want to mention that it's going through the rumor mill. I don't want to talk about the content.
All right. Well, I heard through the rumor mill that the FAQ has kind of been leaked around a little bit, that's coming up, and that, you know, Big Play have it and are, you know, informed.
So we've made it a policy. I mean, even when things, chapter packs are spoiled, we don't talk about the content of the chapter pack until we see some official source. We wait for reviews to go up after the cards are officially
because we don't know if it's real.
Because we don't know if it's real. That said, if this leaked FAQ happens to be real, FFG has to get it out as quickly as possible to give other players as much time as the people who have it in hand.
Yes.
Or if they planted a fake one where two or three of the cards are wrong, well, then awesome. Then I'm just laughing at the false information being disseminated. But
yes, I think that'd be awesome too, because, you know, if they could actually leak certain cards to different audiences, they would know where the leak was coming from.
They actually did this with Netrunner. I don't
know
if you know this.
Great strategy.
It wasn't with the FAQ specifically, but they were having problems with leaks from playtesting.
Yep.
And they wound up catching the source of the leak with basically the single most basic version of having slightly tiny different variations between the sets sent out to different testing groups. And the one that wound up in circulation, they knew which version it was, and they were able to find out who was the source of the leak, which testing group. So I think that would be awesome if that were the case. Mm-hmm. Now, it is worth noting that I would expect the FAQ to come out this week regardless.
Yes,
given
I would
the timing
think so.
From World. So I'm really hoping we get that. Obviously, if we do, we'll be talking about it next week. And we have enough content for this week. I just feel like that we don't want to encourage this level of information disparity where some people have extra weeks
But, I mean, I think honestly that it's very hard for FFG to never give out that additional information. Like, they have playtesters, and they have to, at some point, playtest these FAQs, you would think.
Well, sound optimistic, but yeah, I suppose it's possible. There are a couple other quick things I wanted to go over. The only other piece of news we already mentioned last week remember to apply through your store. Get your store to apply for a store championship. The deadline for that is the 16th of October. If they've been selling well, the core is in your local store. If you've been there, if they know you exist, chances are pretty good they're willing to take this. It's not a big financial investment to just try it out for the next store championship season. And I think it's important to get
this. If you think you got five players that are going to pay $10 each, just buy it yourself.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, in the worst case scenario, you'll make your money back that way.
Yeah, you'll break even.
You got until the 16th to do it. Don't let that fall off your calendar. It would be great to have store championships all over the place. And I'm worried that the fact that these store championships are basically announced in this week right where the cores come out, that the stores are a little bit hesitant to do it if you don't push them to. So
yeah, absolutely. If I was a store, I would be. You know, like, you don't know how it's going to sell. You don't know if you're going to get your money back. You don't make an investment.
Finally, the last thing that I want to talk about, it isn't news, but we got a remarkable amount of very similar feedback last week about how we'd brought DC on again, even though the episode was very different and how, you know, some people have issues with that tone. And, you know, mm-hmm. I joked about last week how you're going to start episodes with apologies, but I don't really want to apologize for that. First of all, I think they have a lot to share. I think their tone is not necessarily one that's conducive to learning from them. But I will say that these people, when we ask them with 20 minutes notice if they can cast, we've had a very tough time scheduling in the last couple of weeks for a number of reasons.
And they were able to do that
for us. They show up. We don't have a queue of 60 people waiting to show up on our show at a moment's notice. And when we get people that have the wide expertise in the game, are willing to show up on the cast, and have a lot to share, we're not going to turn that down.
And the fact that they have an opposite view of us is actually good because it makes for better dialogue. Now, in some cases, like the last show, it was a little bit less back and forth. But in general, they're a good antagonist to, you know, our hero here, the hyena.
Oh, dear. However, this week has no DC. And in the future, if it's really something you object to, there's a reason that I have all these segments so that you can jump between them and you can completely skip a segment without even knowing when it starts and finishes, because that's all labeled in the episode. And just like sometimes there'll be content for beginners that won't be suitable for experts and vice versa, and we try to do that, perhaps sometimes you'll just want to skip a DC segment. But I'm certainly not apologizing for them. I'm actually very thankful for them for coming on the show last week. And I think that pilot or deck turned out quite interesting. We talked about deck marriage. We talked about some other concepts. We talked about short game versus long game, maybe not in as much depth as I'd have liked to. But I thought it was good.
Mm-hmm. I have to agree.
So do you have anything to add?
That is a lot of news, Alex. We're supposed to be short, remember?
I know. That was short. That's as fast as I could make it. I didn't talk about apologizing for all the kid noises that we have in the next couple of segments.
Which we're sorry for.
There we go. It's not a Canadian episode without an apology, and it's not Beyond the Wall without some controversy.
Welcome to another episode of Beyond the Wall. Today we're joined by the hyena, as usual, and Lauren Finch from Boston, and she's going to talk to us a little bit about meta building because she's been instrumental in building the Boston meta. And actually, she had appeared on a previous version of Beyond the Wall, but we had lost the cast because it was the one time that both Alex and I lost our recording simultaneously.
Actually, I wasn't there. I had to bail at the last second, and you lost the recording.
Okay. Are you trying to blame me completely, Alex? Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm blaming myself for not being there. I would have fixed it all if I'd been there.
Okay, good. Yeah. So it's your fault.
Well, I can't guarantee that this one will be as good as the last one.
No,
the last one was amazing.
It was epic, exactly. And no one can prove otherwise.
Yeah, it was pretty great.
Now, before we start, I want to ask John a question. Why do you start every segment with "Welcome to another episode of Beyond the Wall"? Because I just cut that every single time.
I mean, you cut it every time, but I feel it's required so that our guest knows which podcast they're on. Otherwise, they get confused. They might be like, "Oh, I'm on the White Book, this inferior podcast, and I don't really should, you know, I shouldn't talk too much."
I see.
Yeah.
So I guess meta building is extremely relevant, especially over the last couple of days, because we've had
cores
in stores. We've had them all over the world. I've heard reports from Thailand, from Australia, from the UK, from Sweden,
Germany,
Canada. I haven't heard any from Germany, but I'll take your word for it. So, Lauren, have you got your cores?
I had two from Gen Con, but we don't have the third one yet because we actually gave it to a friend. So I've been waiting for the release to get that third one. And unfortunately, our store seems a little bit less up to date on what's going on. So I asked them on Sunday when we went in for our regular play night if they knew when they were coming in, and they had no idea. So
that's not a good sign.
Yeah. they're a really heavy magic store, and they're not as involved with the FFG stuff.
Well, John's store hasn't gotten them yet either, so don't feel bad.
I'm waiting another day or so.
Yeah. But yeah, I figured since I had to get another one that I would get it from the store rather than buying it on Amazon, which would be easy, but you know, not necessarily encouraging the store to stock the FFG.
But I mean, you wouldn't buy from Amazon, right? Because you go to Team Covenant and buy it there.
Yes, you could do that. Do they have free shipping?
No.
They're still awesome. Okay, and moving on. I try to support the people that are doing the content, doing the videos. I mean, I'm willing to pay two extra bucks for the fact that they actually support the game in more ways than just posting it on their site like Amazon does. But anyways, let's go on.
Well, that's why I want to get it from the store.
Yeah, exactly. It's why you go to your brick and mortar, because it's nice to support the local place that's going to actually provide you the space to play.
Mm-hmm. So I've been doing some of the groundwork that might hopefully get a meta started, but I obviously have very little experience with this. I haven't really had a meta in Newfoundland initially, and there wasn't one here in Quebec, and I wasn't going to start one with Game of Thrones sort of moribund. But I was in the store today labeling core sets that had come in that are going on sale tomorrow with a little card pointing people towards a Facebook group and an email address to get in touch so that there could be weekly meetups, and saying that there would be. So I have high hopes. All 36 cores that are going on sale tomorrow have this on them. They've told me that every time they get a new shipment, they'll let me know so I can come in the day that they get the shipment and label future cores as well. So I'm optimistic that I'll have people. So what should I do with them?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, I think that the most important thing is to meet regularly and have it be known when you'll be at the store. So for our group, we play every other Sunday at a game store in Cambridge, in Massachusetts. And having a regular schedule like that helps people know when they can show up and expect other people to be there. I'm hoping that when the group gets a little bit bigger, that we can go back to meeting every week, which we did about a year ago when we had a bigger group before the reboot was announced.
So the first point, you mentioned you have weekly meetups in the store. I've obviously been working with the store. I'm wondering what both of you guys' opinion is on doing these in stores, or doing these in a local pub, doing them somewhere with food, that kind of thing.
Well, we've done pub nights before, and they're generally pretty popular. I wouldn't say that you're going to get any new players at a pub night, pretty much. It's just a way to have fun with your existing meta mates. But we've probably done about 4 or 5 pub nights since the Boston meta reignited about 2 years ago. And they're a lot of fun. And the pub that's near our store has a private room so that we can reserve it and have a ton of space to eat and drink and play games. And typically we go there after our tournaments or even play final matches there. So I think people like it, and I definitely think it's a positive thing.
You know, I disagree with Lauren a little bit in the fact that I don't think you'll get new players at a pub night. The thing is, if your pub night is your meetup location, that's always the place that you always meet at, then yes, you'll get new players. Mm-hmm. So what we've done here is that because none of our stores are open late enough downtown, and we wanted a location that would allow for people coming over the bridge from Gatineau, that we chose a pub that would be open later. So if people take the time to drive for 30 minutes and get here, that they'd be able to play for, you know, until 1 a.m. if they wanted. Mm-hmm. And the fact that we chose a pub and that's where we meet every single week at that pub, we get new players showing up at the pub to play Game of Thrones, but we also have Netrunner and Star Wars and even Cthulhu going on. So that if you're an LCG player, you know that showing up at that pub that night will let you play your LCG. It's kind of a place for growth.
I'm sort of leaning with Lauren here, though, because I prefer being in a pub for many reasons, but one of the advantages of playing within a store is if you're there that evening and people are coming in to buy other games, see this. And
see, we have a local online distributor that shows up at the pub, and if people want to buy new stuff, they have a mechanism to do that as well. So if you wanted the most recent chapter pack, if you wanted, you know, a different game or a board game, you could actually go through these guys and buy it.
But I think the other way around, though, where you're playing and some person's walking into the store to go pick up their Magic boosters, or they're walking into the store because they're looking for a new board game to buy, and they see these 10, 15 people, I'm an optimist, playing this game, and they wonder, oh, what is it? And then they may sit down and join you, or they may decide to buy it then in the store. That allows you to pull in new players that were going into the store before because they get to see the game played. I think that's
probably an
advantage.
But, I mean, we have True North Games kind of sponsors all the tournaments at this pub as well. And that allows new players that, you know, don't have exposure to the Thrones, but have exposure to these other LCGs or there's other games to come. And because that night is kind of like a general gaming night, we still have that same throughput that you would have at a store, but in a pub. Mm-hmm. And why isn't it better with beer? It is.
It sounds like a really special circumstance that you guys have there. It sounds pretty
neat. Right. If you were just playing only Game of Thrones at the pub, I would agree with you. But because it's like this huge range of games, it's different. It's almost like a store with beer.
Well, if you have a store with beer, that solves most of the problems. The argument's moot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like the FFG Center, I would imagine that's an awesome place to go play.
Exactly, yeah.
All right, so that's location somewhat handled. What do you guys feel about content? Should, especially early on, should it be demo decks? I mean, I'm obviously going to be bringing decks for people to play with. Should there be little mini tournaments? Should it be a league? How do you get players involved?
I'll tell you what I did, and then I'll let Tor and Lauren tell you what she did. But for me, I did a ton of demos. I did a ton of tournaments where it was a restricted card pool, where there was only, you know, cores allowed, where there's only cores plus expansion allowed. Now, that's not so important now that we have 2.0 where everyone's just playing with cores.
Anyone who isn't is cheating.
Right. So, I mean, you can say only one core's allowed or only two cores allowed, and that allows you to have new players coming in and feeling like they don't have to make a huge investment of $120. They only have to make $40.
It's $150 now with the exchange rate.
Okay, yeah, well, so they only have to make a $40 purchase in order to play in a tournament setting, which will give them a kind of a taste for what a tournament is. And I think that's so important for new players, especially ones that have a competitive feel, like maybe they're coming from Magic or some other game where they were extremely competitive. And to be able to win something like that with a single core, or be competitive at least, will give them a good sense of what Thrones is.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we've done things a little bit differently with our group. Overall, we've had a lot of our new players come from other games. So recently, a lot of our new 2.0 players are people who play Conquest mostly. And so they've been at the store at the same time that we're playing Thrones, because it's an open gaming night. And so they've seen us playing Thrones, and they were waiting for 2.0 to come out. And now that it's coming out, they're interested in playing. So they're pretty skilled card game players. And so for the most part, we started off with having some smaller decks similar to the demo decks that have deck lists in the core set. But we've recently switched over to having people play regular decks, so constructed 3-core style. And one of the reasons we feel like that's okay is that we're very generous in loaning cards and also in allowing people to play with proxies, because we feel like in a casual environment where you want to get people playing the game, then it doesn't really matter whether they own the cards or not. But in order to really let the game shine, we'd rather let them play with all of the cards.
On this point, so the last one I was leaning more Lauren. On this one, I might be leaning a little more John. I think the idea of at least starting off with the decks from the core set, and they're fairly high variance decks, I think that's actually a good thing. High variance is not inherently bad. It's bad at the
competitive. I agree. It lets everyone feel like they have a chance in any given game.
Yeah.
And you're not worried about player skill. So a new player that's never played any LCG, that's never played Magic or whatever, feels like they might have won that game.
I mean, there are many extremely low variance games like chess where it all boils down to skill, and therefore I don't play a lot of chess, because every time I lose, I blame it entirely on how bad a player I am. So I think that having some high variance introductions is not necessarily a bad thing. My goal is obviously, and I think this is probably wise, I'll show up with a bunch of variants, high variance demo decks. I'll show up with some constructed decks. And, I mean, I've got four cores now. I should have enough to build a fair few decks and be able to give them to people to play on those game nights, at least early on before people start to get their own card pool and they invest the money in it. So I guess the next sort of question here is, how do you get them coming back? I mean, obviously, you need to be there every week. You need to make sure that it's a regular meeting and you know, certain people need to make sure that they're there every week. You can't have a week where there's no one there, someone shows up and goes, oh, this isn't worth it. But how do you get the other players to come back regularly to keep them coming back so that you hit that critical mass?
Well, one thing that we've done in Boston, we don't generally play a structured league or a tournament. We usually play just pickup games with whoever's there. But one way that we've come up with something to reward players for showing up and for trying new decks and interesting things and kind of getting out of their comfort zone is with this achievements poster that we put together a couple of years ago for 1.0. And you guys should be able to see it. I sent you the link.
So walk me through this.
All right. So we made this poster. Actually, it's we printed it out. It's pretty enormous. And then we had it laminated. And we bring it to the store every week. And it's laminated so you can write on it with Sharpie and wipe it off. And so the way that it works is you can see that across the top are people's names. If I was going to do this over again, I would probably leave that blank so that we could just write them in and reuse the poster every season or something like that. And then down the left, there are different achievements that people can get when they come to the store to play. So some of them are pretty obvious. So first win, first loss. The house words are representative of getting a win with that house. So ours is the Fury, means you won with a Baratheon house card. And then there's various different achievements. Some of them we went through pretty quickly, and then some of them were rather difficult. We had tried to be creative in coming up with some of these achievements. But then the idea was that we would give prizes to people that got the most achievements that day, that month, etc. So it rewarded people for coming into the store, but also for trying new things and getting creative with their deck building.
Which is great, because you don't want people to come in with only the best deck in the meta every single week. That's not fun. It's fun to change it up, try new things. So I think that's a good way to kind of reward those people that are willing to take the risk to play something different or something that's not the best deck, you know, quote, quote.
And I can already think of a bunch of achievements that would work even for the 2.0 core set, you know. Win with a non-Night's Watch deck that doesn't have Noble Cause in it. You know, things like
win
that.
With yeah. every house, right?
And then houses. You can see
that. You have to come multiple times to do that.
Oh, yeah, that was our Champion of the Realm achievement. But you can see there are some that are also not related specifically to decks, but we have bring a friend, play 5 different people, play 10 different people. So those are That's also great. Encouraging people to, you know, to build the meta themselves to help.
To socialize, yeah.
Yeah. So we really like this, and I plan on updating this poster for 2.0 and getting it back in the store because it was really popular. And also just having the poster hung over our play area in the store meant that a lot of times people would just come over to see what this thing was, and then we would end up talking to them about Thrones.
Because it's huge, yeah.
Yeah.
So where did you advertise to get people to come into the store? Was it just in the store, or did you try other places? When I did it, I tried libraries. I tried local events where they were playing board games. We had some board game meetups. I passed that out. I went to my stores. I put up posters like Alex did. I put cards on chapter packs and core sets. So what did you do?
I think we've been really lucky at having a good community at the store that we typically play at. So I haven't really gone to other locations to try to recruit members. I do a bit online. I'll post about events that we're having, both on Agar Cards, on Card Game DB, and on the Reddit page for the game. And I've definitely gotten nibbles from those.
I think it's really important, actually, like you're saying, to have an online presence, to go to Reddit, to go to meetups, to go to, you know, whatever your local, I'll say your geek pages, you know, I'm putting quotes again there. Wherever your geeks would go to interact with board games or try new things, you should go there. You should post, and don't be scared to go on the TV show pages as well in your local area. Post, see if people are interested in trying to play the card game.
Before we go on to John about ways you've retained players. Laura, you mentioned you wanted to have little prizes for most achievements in a night or in a month or however you want to do that. What kind of prizes were you talking about? How did you set about getting these? Was this something you worked out with the store or just had people pitch in? Was there some entrance fee, that kind of structure?
Mostly it's come from our stash of prizes, meaning Brits, mine, and other players in the meta. I think that if you want to build the meta, sometimes you just have to contribute stuff on your own. We've done things like buy the Game of Thrones beer that came out over the last couple of years, and we'll give those away. So a lot of it's just been stuff that we've sort of found on our own. You know, I TO'd store championship last year, and then Britt and I went to about five. So we ended up with like five Cersei mats. So, you know, stuff like that ends up getting given away as prizes. And then there's things that we just purchase because we want to have nice prizes to give out to people.
All right. So, John, what did you do to help with retention?
Man, I wish I could say that I did a lot, but that wouldn't be true.
Or what did your meta do to help with retention?
There we go.
It doesn't just have to be you.
My meta took it up a lot more aggressively than me with my current work and family life. I don't have a chance to show up to every single game night, so my meta really stepped up and started doing prizes like Lauren talked about. They did kind of like a sheet similar to Lauren where depending on what you did any given week, you would have categories you could win in. And they actually started to reach out to other LCG communities in the area to make sure that we were all going to the same place at the same time so that there was a little bit of cross-pollination going on between all these different groups. And it helped so much that it was kind of incredible, the amount of extra players that would show up at these events, to the point where we fill most of the bar now, thanks to Netrunner in a large part, but it's still great because those Netrunner players also play Game of Thrones, with at least saw it in 1.0 and got interested for 2.0, so that now we have these players that want to buy those core sets, that want to try the game, that may come over and play AGOT as a primary game in this year.
When they come to their senses, yeah.
Excellent. Yeah. When they wake up.
So I have another topic that sort of comes up every once in a while. There are a couple of different, you know, there's this Kingslayer format, and I was talking about some of the advantages to that. What about Melee versus Joust? Do you guys feel in teaching players, but also as a regular event or as part of these, or should the two be kept fairly separate? It's not the
Alex,
same achievement.
That's a great question. I think depending on the group you're trying to recruit to Game of Thrones depends on the type of game you should play. So if you're going to like a board gaming group that's used to playing competitively against four or five players, Melee might actually be your better option to try to recruit those players than Joust, even though Joust is the more popular game. But if you're going to like Magic, where they're used to one-on-one play, then obviously Joust would be the one you would use. So for me, when I showed up at board gaming nights, I actually introduced new players to Melee before Joust, and that paid off in dividends for me because that's where I kind of recruited the largest number of players for the Ottawa meta.
Wow. I can see the logic in that, but trying to teach Melee to four new players sounds like a Herculean task, so I have to give you kudos for that.
Herculean sounds like the right choice of words. I mean, there's a lot going on in a Melee game, and it goes very slowly if people don't have a grasp of the cards in the game.
So I did 3 hours each for Melee. I ran two Melees at the same time, and I was basically maxed out. So eight players was about as much as I could teach for a three-hour Melee game, which is way longer than you should ever play Melee. Mm-hmm. But board gamers were used to about a three-hour game for their board game, so they're happy with that. Mm-hmm. Because if you do Civilization or you do Ticket to Ride or any of these games, it's about 2 to 3 hours. So they were okay with 3 hours. They were used to that, and they were happy.
What? Ticket to Ride is 2 to 3 hours? I must be playing it wrong.
Okay. Ticket to Ride tournaments is 1.5 to 2 hours.
Really?
You go to the Worlds at Gen Con, you got 1.5 hours to play. That's top tier Ticket to Ride.
Mm-hmm. Well, in Boston, we have some people who like to play Melee and some who don't. So
you have some people that know the Game of Thrones is awesome and some that don't.
Yeah, personally, I enjoy Melee, so I'm always trying to get people to play more.
That's because you're right, Lauren.
I mean, most of the time. So we've had a Melee tournament last summer. That was pretty good. I think we got about 16 people to show up for that. and we do play melee pickup games. One thing that I've tried to do in the past is to say, okay, we're meeting every Sunday night. The first Sunday night of the month is going to be melee night, so bring your melee decks. Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't, but I think having some kind of structure is good, especially when, you know, you want people to show up week after week. It can be a good idea to have like different little mini events that you do.
And out of curiosity, do you treat it the same way for your achievements poster, for instance? Are there achievements specific to melee, or is winning a game, it doesn't matter whether it's melee or joust for the achievements, or is that a separate consideration?
No, we combined them on the poster. So winning a melee game, for example, with Martell would get you the Martell achievement on the poster. But yeah, it would be a great idea to include some melee specific achievements if you wanted to try to encourage melee play in your meta.
I think melee play is super fun. It's not for everyone, just like joust isn't for everyone. We have a few players, strangely enough, that only play melee. Now, they don't come out to our local meetups because they feel that those meetups are actually focused on joust. Mm-hmm. So they play a lot in as casual players. But I think that if we had a melee night, they would show up, because mm-hmm. they would know that that's the game that's going to play. Sadly, we don't do that here in Ottawa, but it's a good idea, Alex.
John's already competing for his melee tournaments. He makes sure none of his...
Yeah, no practice. I'm going to own. Though we did have, excellent. How many people did we have in the Ottawa National? Well, sorry, Canadian National. Like 30 or 40 people? Yeah.
For the melee tournament? We were shy of 30. I think we were at 26 or 28.
That seems
pretty good. I do want to actually end this. So you mentioned that you have little prizes for people who win out these achievements. I'm sure it's something that you'll continue mm-hmm. on to 2.0. We've recently been given some things that we decided we were going to hand out as prizes. What would you say to a set of Team Covenant tokens mailed to you to give out as a prize to one of these tournaments?
I would say thank you very much.
Well, then you'd best
excellent.
Get me your mail.
Yeah, address. that would be great. People would like that a lot.
So, John, you didn't know this, but as of now, every single week we're going to have a new segment, and it's going to be tips for players new to the game. Deck building, whatever, just a short little 2 to 3 minute segment every week to make sure we always factor in the new player.
Great.
So,
tip number one,
a technique for building your plot decks that I really, really like and I think is very good for people who have a grasp on the plot deck pool but not necessarily on the intricacies of building. And this is, don't build a plot deck, play with opponents, and pick the plot you want as if you had the right plots in your deck.
Yep, and write it down.
So you play your opponent and you say, man, every time I always want to have Wildfire. I use it in every single game. That's definitely going in my plot deck. Same thing with Filthy Accusation, Fortified Position. How often do you feel that's the number one plot for that for your deck at that point?
Yep. Play 50 games like that and you'll know your plot deck because you'll just choose the plots that you chose over that range of games the most.
There's a name for this plot thing, but I don't actually know what it is.
There really is a name for it?
Yeah, I think it transferred from some other game where there's some system where... Anyway, but the first time I heard of it was on a now-defunct 2C1C podcast. It's something that some world-class players have done, and I think it's an excellent idea. The catch is that it requires that you be quite familiar with the plots or have them next to you, all 26 plots in the core.
If you're playing online on Octagon, you can just have the whole thing up. And that's actually something that new players should do. Get on Octagon. Get there, get a whole bunch more games than you could ever in real life in through the online playing mechanism of Octagon.
And obviously, clear this with your opponent before you do. If your opponent wants to play a match to test their own deck and, they could do the same thing as you, but if they really want to play what looks like a tournament match, they're not going to appreciate it when you always have the right plot. But you can learn a lot about plot deck building from basically always having the best of the 26 possible plots. So to start us off, the idea for this segment, we're joined by Drakey all the way from Finland, who is just telling me about having opened but not yet sorted his cards, which sounds decidedly unrules lawyer obsessive compulsive of him. And the goal here is to go over the top 10 decks in first edition. Now, we were extremely clear that we're not clear at all on what top 10 means. We probably all took a different version of this. Someone might have put the top 10 innovators, others the top 10 deck they might have liked to play, others the top 10 performing. I'm not sure what you guys have, but let's get this started. Drakey, do you want to give us one of the decks off your list?
Well, since I have kind of concentrated a lot on what are historically important, which decks had made big changing points in how the game was seen and played, I guess it's quite clear that my first deck will be Lannister Hyperneil, which really dominated the early phases of the game, especially the DC-built Hyperneil versions dominated early part of the game and later became iconized first in Europe and also then spread a bit more to the United States as the Alvaro-style Lannister No Agenda Neil decks.
I actually had that one on my list at number one because I was going chronologically as well. I had Lannister Hyperneil. It started awesome in the core, and up until 2010, it was still basically the best deck or among the best decks. Alec Irwin took it to a championship in 2010, winning a card design. Plenty of variations. Some of them were City of Shadows eventually during some periods. Some of them were just No Agenda. And then we have the most recent versions, the Alvaro version. I couldn't pick a version specifically. This was my biggest cop-out. I just said Lannister Hyperneil.
Yeah. But I think, to me, it's the first ones by the DC meta, which really sort of gave an idea of what competitive Thrones will be like.
So, John, want to give us something from your list then?
See, Lannister Hyperneil was not on my list because everyone was doing it. It was like an out-of-the-box obvious choice, I thought. So because of that, I said that wasn't really defining. That really didn't shake it. Yeah, it was the best deck for a long time, and it's still really good, but I don't find it was innovating. I don't think it was cool.
Well, I think it's good to mention in context, too, with the new 2.0 core set, where people are going, oh, Neil is so powerful. Yeah, it is in a small card pool before you can have that redundancy of characters when they can target your best and say no challenges for you.
Sure, but that would be like choosing Martell Maesters at its peak as one of the best decks in the meta or something like that. To me, it's not
one of us has.
So I'll choose a deck from that time period, and I'm going to say the Super Maester Bob, Shadow Bob deck, and the in the same vein, the which is basically the same type of concept, the Killer of the Wounded Maester, where there was this period of time where people abused the change to such an awesome level. I thought it was great.
That one narrowly avoided. It was on my list initially, both the Uber Bob or the Uber Joffrey versions, the other ones, but in the end I picked another deck that was similar that came from that. So I actually did not count in the Uber Bob, the Uber Maesters from those initial versions of the Maesters. And the reason I didn't, it's a little unfair, it's that the agenda was so broken at the time that there were so many ways to break it. That shouldn't take away from the decks, but it means that I actually have a lot of appreciation for some of the things that worked out of Maesters after they sort of fixed it.
Yeah, but you have to remember that those decks were extremely susceptible to other broken things at the time, like Gaston Grey, where you could still use a 2-coster to pop a 7-cost if you wanted back to hand. So making them resilient enough to Gaston Grey was actually the difficult part. It wasn't just about Bob. It was the fact that you were stacking Bob with, double dupes or three dupes because you were using those guys that can dupe characters that are noble.
Loyal Guard.
Yeah, Loyal Guard and all these other little interactions that made the deck actually complicated to make. So it wasn't like an easy deck to create, and that's why you saw so few of them at Gen Con that year.
That was,
and you saw like a billion Gaston Grey decks.
All right, because I have something from that same tournament that I'd like to mention. So the second deck on my list, moving chronologically, was the Martell Knights of the Hollow Hill from Greg at Gen Con 2011. This is Dobler's masterpiece to me. It's a work of art. It had Men with No King, Pyre of the False Guards, reinforcement events. It was weird. The real meat was the Bannerman, the Parting Blow, the Narrow Escape. It has 5 or 6 cards that wound up on the restricted list. But the real reason this deck is on the list is not because it's amazing, but also because it was basically the first big breakthrough, the first big hit for Knights of the Hollow Hill.
It's on my list too, Alex.
It's all well. I have also Martell Knights of the Hollow Hill, but I actually have the very first one that made a big breakthrough, which is actually before that.
Tell me more.
It's Fat Mouse's version, right a bit after Knights of the Hollow Hill came out, which was basically a Beric and Viper Voltron deck that he ran in, I think, it was Black Friday, what's it called? It had some really epic stories about how that tournament went, written on FFG boards back then. And that's the first time I ever saw Hollow Hill used anywhere in the way, at least. And the way it was being used was really interesting because it had stuff like Red Warlocks to help make the Beric and Viper Voltrons work and so forth.
Excellent. So we all had a different version of essentially that same idea of acknowledging the first breakthrough of Knights of the Hollow Hill.
Yeah. And I also actually was really close to coming to Greg's version because the interaction between Bannerman and Narrow Escape is just completely hilarious.
Oh, it was. It was fantastic.
But coming back to the Maesters, did you have any Maester decks?
I did. I did have a Maester deck. Did you? I chose Jeff Chafo's Targ Maester's Path, Rusted Maesters, the winner of Batalla por el Muro in 2013. This was after the related restrictions. It was when Maesters had sort of faded out into the background. And then with some of these new cards that really enabled the tower build, this really refined version came out of that tournament. And then has since been used in a lot of different ways, with more trait manipulation, with more dragon stuff, with more all sorts of fun little tricks. But to me, the core of that was the Rusted Maesters, the Rusted Swords with the standing location that allowed that deck to form the foundation for a lot of Maester play thereafter. And because this happened after TMP had been so heavily hit, I wanted to give massive credit to Jeff Chafo and whoever else he was working with for that particular
build. Yeah, that was a beautiful build, and I actually cut it from my top 10. It was basically my 11th, but it got cut for a melee deck, so I think that's worthwhile, right? Because how many of you guys have melee decks on your list?
Yeah, then, well, I didn't put any melee decks on my list, so that'll be fine. I look forward to hearing yours. So did you have Drakey?
Yeah, I had. Well, I actually was really torn between two versions of Maester's Path. The first one, which I in the end didn't choose, was the very first Lannister Maester's Path decks, the ones that actually led to Carrion Bird becoming errated using the trait manipulation, and then Carrion Bird as repeatable removal, because those really sort of shifted things when they came around, and it was a pretty interesting point in that regional season, and they got really quickly errated out because of that. But the one I ended keeping was Tavian Tudian, Dan from the New York meta.
Oh, so his initial Targ burn?
Yeah, the one that used Pyromancer's Cache as the draw, which was cheating in. And it had also interesting stuff like Pyrophobia, which is the first time I ever saw that event being used. And a lot of other the really interesting stuff, which, because that's, to me, that's the deck where I really learned how you can push the cards in a Maester deck, what you can really do with them if you start tricking around with them. And that's the one deck that for me led to really sort of getting interested in the agenda, and that was like half a year, just later than the first Erratas, I think.
All right. So, John, up to you. Give us the next deck on your list. We've now
talking about some Maesters, and before that we're talking about 222, I'm going to go back to 222 because I have two 222 decks also still on my list. I have the Bera 222 that took Shalik back, where they were, you know, the reanimator type of deck, which
Tarkin's Bera.
Yeah, Tarkin's Bera. It was a beautiful deck. I mean, it was slick. It was a great meta call, and it also forced kind of a big stream of erratas to that agenda because of how powerful it was. But I also put on the House of Pain just because that jumper deck was out there, but it really didn't come home until the Worlds, where John Bruno took it for the win.
Yeah, I also have a House of Pain on my list. And I think a really important point there is that the games were streamed. It was one of the sort of really first tournaments where you got good streamed games going. And people could see online in streamed games what that deck was really doing. And it really changed the meta overnight after that, I think.
I mean, it's important to note that, first of all, this wasn't the first Targ Knights of the Hollow Hill.
No,
there were plenty of them being played in Europe. It wasn't particularly innovative in any specific aspect, but it flew under the radar. Bruno built a very good version of this deck, and it stayed a force in the meta even after the restrictions of Street Wave and Long Lances and all these other things and Hatchling's Feast, and you still saw versions of this deck. I mean, I think there were way better versions of the deck afterwards. For instance, I think one of the greatest innovations was the addition of Bungled Orders, made a world of difference to that deck. It certainly was refined then after. But I think that one was just so meta-impacting that I have that one on the list. I did not have the Baron Knights of the Hollow Hill. it just fell off the list by two or three places because I have another Tarkin deck on the list because we've already talked to Martell and about this Targ version. I just felt I wasn't going to put that one. But I think House of Pain needs to be on the list.
Yeah. Actually, I think we need to also credit Widowmaker here because and that year, for the store's original season, Bruno put out a question for a quest for decks. So send him a deck list and he'll choose the best one and he'll work on that. And the one that he accepted finally was Widowmaker's Targ Arena at the Hollow Hill, which they then worked on since the store/regional season up until Worlds.
It's also worth noting that it was my first loss in competitive play ever, and it was perfectly suited to demolishing my really, really gimmicky Greyjoy Night's Watch deck. He was looking in my hand with confessions and waste their time and picking out the cards that I needed to keep in hand to use with the wall. Completely demolished me. First loss ever. John Bruno. Very painful. So it certainly had to make my list there. So then, since we have the same version of that, so Drake, you want to move on to something else on your list?
I'll again go back in time, sort of going back and forth, but go back in time to Stark Siege. And there, I'm really talking, this is sort of because the Stark Siege has been a thing that's going on and off and on and off ever since it came out. And when it came out, it was sort of really shook the game by how actually fast it was, because it had the very first deck that really did first turn wins through Epics and through Rush. And it was a bit of a thing feared at that moment. But the version I want to credit is actually Gualdo's, and it's a Spanish guy who was also involved. It's the version that ran like 42 characters and very little draw. It's the one Gualdo then took to a tourney in the US, only used losing to, I think, Dan there, or something like in the final, something like that. But the thing that really shook me there was it compensated for the fact that it wasn't drawing all that much, which simply having so many really efficient characters at like 42 cards in a 60 card deck, so it could always every single turn consistently draw good characters with aggressive keywords, get them out, and then just really expert players playing the challenge math to perfection, and it's really just a cool thing to see.
Actually, Siege was one of the two decks that I felt sort of needed an acknowledgement, but just I could not get a version and an iteration to squeeze into my list. So it's that and Mera of Knights of the Realm with the aggressive plot deck. I felt I wanted to acknowledge those two decks. I just couldn't squeeze them onto the list.
I have a Stark Siege as well, but it's actually the melee version that use a standing Jamie to be able to get a renowned character in all those epic battles.
The version DC was playing?
That was a fantastic deck. Yeah, DC brought that to Melee 1 year. They did extremely well with it, and I think it's worth props because it was winning on turn one a lot in Melee.
Yeah, I have to agree. I think Siege is perfect here because it has worked in both formats and in with crushing sort of impacts on the meta, on what it could...
Yeah.
I want to make a quick note. For that Stark Siege, I remember you thinking, oh, this is coming, and I know it's going to come. So what was the card you put in your deck that year? Was it Rhaegar Targaryen?
I did. I put in Rhaegar Targaryen.
End the phase and went all the
all their epic goals away.
I
thought
that was fantastic.
It was kind of mean, but and I was also using non-kneeling dragons, right? So epic battles didn't hurt me. If I had a Beleriand on the table and he wasn't kneeling, I was in okay shape if Jamie came my way.
Yeah. That's also the reason why I sort of got around to almost always running Lineage and Legacy in my decks.
So they have to declare the power challenge.
Yeah, and with the epic phases, they can never just do them.
They can never do their melee, yeah. Very nice.
So I have another acknowledgement from, I think that's that year, because that was 2013.
Yes.
And from Gen Con, and I actually have two acknowledgements from that year. The first, and this is basically an embodiment for all of these DC extreme efficiency decks. This is the Martell No Agenda that won that year. DC decks are both extremely efficient cards. They don't tend to run answers. They tend to run that. And I think they've had the Lightning Darkwings, Dark Wars. They've had lots of other decks that have showcased this. I think this is the one that embodies it all. Brute forced its way to a mirror match in the finals. It was the strongest deck in that field. And I think it embodies everything, both about Martell No Agenda, which is a phenomenal deck, and about the DC philosophy behind deck building that has highly influenced the metagame as a whole.
Okay,
But since we're talking about Melee, and I don't want to leave Melee here, there's a couple other Melee decks, and one of them's actually a DC creation. They got disqualified for it. And I think the Melee deck they ran with the Scourge combo that would remove all the icons on the board if two of them were sitting together was an extremely innovative deck. And I know it was originally built by Dan from New York. And it actually led me to one of my other favorite Melee decks, which is Dan's Brimstone Icon Control deck, which is just so innovative and so much fun. I think that we can't forget about some of these really cool Melee decks that people have built.
I agree. I didn't even think of Melee in the decks, because I always think that the decks matter less in Melee. Not to say that they don't matter, they are some phenomenal creations, but because I think it is more about the play, as long as you have a deck that has a path to victory, that I just didn't click that I could put Melee decks on this list. I would definitely have put that Brimstone had I been able to.
Yeah.
I even love the Unkillable Dragons that we played 1 year, Alex. I think that was an extremely fun Melee deck that's worth going on the list, because it was the first time I saw something like that in Melee. All right, we'll go back to Joust now.
Back to Joust Gen Con 2013. So, yeah, I was saying that for me, the DC list there was really the embodiment of DC lists.
I'll beg to disagree, because on my list I have DC Martel Summer.
You guys have way too much DC on your list. Like, really? These guys just play efficient cards. Their decks aren't cool.
They've still highly affected the way the game is perceived. And
sure.
Decks.
But they're not fun.
No, a lot of my decks are fun.
I got, like, Marathion and, like, the Greyjoy No Character deck where they're Rainy Hill Cycle.
The only DC deck I've mentioned so far is this Martel No Agenda.
Yep, now there's a Summer or something. It's like, come on.
I didn't have the No Agenda. I just have this one, which is... Well, come on. This is the deck that initially got Burning of the Sand, Venomous Blade, Kings of Summer, Viper's Bannerman, basically every single Martel broken toy in the same deck at the same time. And that's really the deck that I think made Martel a curse word. And that's why I think this deck needs to be on this
that's
list.
That's quite good. That was Gen Con 2011 still, I
think. That's actually
right?
more of the regional season in 2012, I think.
Yeah, they didn't play that at Gen Con, I don't think.
It was the regional season, but the whole regional season was owned by that thing. And I think they sort of got hangover by the fact that other people also started playing it a lot, so it got really popular that season. And honestly, there wasn't a good way to beat that thing when it was out.
I'm going to have to go, so I'm just going to rhyme off the decks that I thought had a great impact on the Joe scene. I think Marathion, I think Greg Atkinson's low character Greyjoy Rainy's Hill deck, and he wasn't actually the original builder, so I'd love to actually credit the person that originally built that, because it was posted prior to that. He just kind of refined it.
So
and then
was that?
I don't know. I wish I did, because he deserves the credit, not Greg deserves credit for the refinement and everything, but there was a version that was out before. And then probably something that neither of you guys have, a Stark City of Shadows plot cycling deck. This was the first time I ever saw the Bran Stark abuse, which led to a whole bunch of Bran Stark abuse decks later. But in this one, it was a City of Shadows where they were using search plots, and they were cycling those search plots to get basically card advantage. And I think it won a European tournament, and it was televised. But again, I don't know the name of the builder.
Yeah, I remember that also, but my memory is also shot.
You have to leave. That's such a shame. I have such a deck that I think you'll enjoy quite a bit that you missed, John, that you missed.
Oh, quick now, Alex. Quick then. Tell me them.
All right. Well, one of the ones I wanted to mention was the French National Combo deck by Orion Glaser in 2014.
Oh, that one.
The Martel House of Dreams Dorne. This was the Georgian Reed combo deck. It was basically the only true combo in the sort of magic sense, game-winning combo from that to ever win a major tournament that I know of. It was, basically widely broadcasted thereafter. There were restrictions thereafter. This was deck-building innovation and a completely different approach to winning. I mean, we've had combos like Maester's Pass where you're wiping an entire board, but this, for me, was the combo deck of Thrones in the LCG.
Yeah.
But John really does have to leave us. So, Drakey and I, we still have quite a few things on our lists, four or five decks.
Yeah.
So what did you have then? Before I go to a really self-serving one, what did you have?
Well, then I won't go into my self-serving one, but I'll go into what taught me what aggro is. And that's the 6th Agenda Stark Night's Watch Wildling decks. That could really sort of use Val and plunk on the table 7 strength stealth deadly characters for 1 gold, slipping them off the deck, sort of, blip, 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 blip. and it was ridiculous. It was completely ridiculous. Seeing a few, two of those playing against each other was completely horrid, because there was like 15 characters on both sides. Neither player was running any resets, of course not. Both were trying to play to what?
21 power. Oh, no, 27 more. Power.
27 power, yeah. It was horrible. I mean, that's still the most broken state I've kind of seen the game ever in.
And that's saying something, yes.
That's saying something, yes.
All right, so since I'm moving chronologically, I mentioned Gen Con 2013. I mentioned I had two decks from it. This is incredibly self-serving, but I believe that this makes the top 10 list, and this is Greyjoy Black Sails that John and I built in 2013. I think it was the first, and this is going to sound horribly egotistical, I think it was the first good Black Sails deck to come out. I think there was a lot of experimenting with it, and there were Black Sails decks that had won out of Bera. There had been some play with it in Melee and Targ, and some attempts to get it to work in Greyjoy. But I think this one set a lot of the rules that then went on to be used to make a lot of other Black Sails decks. I love this deck. We spent a ton of time tweaking it, really refining it for the meta. I was super happy with playing it at Gen Con. It performed super well, so I'm biased. But I also think that it opened up a lot of doors within the Black Sails meta, which, you know, led to things like Targ Black Sails, which is another deck I love, played again to great success.
I was actually really close also to adding that, so I think it's not self-serving that badly. I ended up going with another Greyjoy deck instead, but that really is a really phenomenal deck, I do agree.
So you mentioned you'd have a self-serving one. Do you want to give me your self-serving one?
Well, mine is Baratheon Knights. I haven't pinned down a version of this. I mean, I think I would like to pin down the Cavalry Charge deck that I personally ran to a Starlock cut, and James ran 2 or 3 years later to a Starlock cut. But I think the one we should really be talking about was an Italian one, which was the one I sort of built mine around later on. And I think the point there was the kind of, it's a really different kind of Baratheon that existed before Knights became a thing. And the real point there is the kind of concept of pressure on all fronts. Your board is getting hit, your hand is getting hit, and it's gaining power at an alarming speed. And it's stealing your characters at locations. Everything at the same time. Sort of this huge impact from the first round.
I did mention earlier that there was a Baronites that I felt that we've often called on the cast as the sort of Euro Baronites.
Yeah. You
know, the one that runs Fear of Winter or Rule by Decree or First Nowhere, all sorts of these more aggressive plot decks. And I always felt that was a really interesting take on Knights, because Knights has the card advantage built in, and yeah. You can play that longer game, but the amount of pressure it could put in the early game, Blockade as well, made various iterations of that. So I would have loved to be able to include that. It just couldn't make the top 10 list for me, sadly.
Yeah, and I think the best way to call it is that the European style of Baratheon Knights, because that's really what it was. There were different variants running around, and different people have been running it since with similar versions of that. But it's really sort of common. It's sort of really an European thing in very different areas that's sort of emerging at the same time.
Mm-hmm. It's actually, I was interested that in my list overall at what percentage were European decks. It was quite high, including this next one on my list from spring 2014 from the Octagon tournament. The winner there was Stark No Agenda. That was then called Grand Theft Location.
Yeah, I have that too.
See, the reason I have this is not because Stark No Agenda didn't exist before or because this is the best version of Stark No Agenda there is. What I loved about this deck was this was a very high Knights of the Hollow Hill meta, falling off from Stalic, the Baron Knights of the Hollow Hill, falling off from it was a really good time for things like Martell Knights of the Hollow Hill. And this was a deck that rather than take the approach that we did with the Greyjoy Black Sails of canceling, depriving events, rather than taking this, just said, look, I'm going to survive the Valor with some Stark tricks where I'll always have characters to replay. I may not have saves or anything like that. I'm going to have characters to replay, and I am going to whittle down your resource base and deprive you of options, and I will win. And the way that deck used Mira to blank resources, the way that deck could just – it was such a great deck for that meta. I love it. And so Grand Theft Location makes my list at number 7.
Yeah. It makes my list as well. But I really think the point there is it was the deck that really drove home what a beast of a card Mira Reed is. It did it even better than Stark Winter ever did.
I agree.
So how many do you have left?
I have two decks left. That was my number 7, but my 8 was the French National combo deck that I wanted to run off. So yeah. I have two decks left on my list. And yourself?
I have one.
So all right, so I'll go through one more of mine then. So I did mention that I had a Tarkin deck on my list. So this one at number 9 in Bataille 2014, Greyjoy the Old Way.
Oh, that one, yeah.
Yeah, now, obviously, a lot of people hated what that deck became. It had a lot of improvements on it, just like some of the other decks we've made. It became better with time. But this was Miguel Tarkin at his deck-building genius, as usual, rising to the top of a Swiss in which there were tons of bloodthirst, and this was a deck that was reasonably well-suited to beating this character light play. Was a very, very different deck, and it wasn't how people thought Old Way was going to work initially. They thought Old Way was going to be pushing these unopposed challenges rather than deterring from a defensive standpoint, and this was the first deck to really drive home what Old Way could do. I think I had to have a Tarkin deck somewhere in my top 10, and I decided that since I had so many Hollow Hills, it was going to be the Greyjoy Old Way.
Yeah, that's a really good choice. I was really tempted in adding the Old Way as well. I kind of ended up just not, because I wanted to concentrate a bit more on a sort of historic decks because I figured it was bringing another angle. But yeah, that's... And I mean, I never felt it to be that negative, I think. I think it just sort of showed showed how invulnerable locations tend to be in first edition.
So your very last one.
Greyjoy the Long Voyage.
Interesting.
Because this is an interesting one. Because I figured I needed to have one Greyjoy on the list. And the reason I actually went with Greyjoy the Long Voyage is because, well, I thought somebody needs to bring the Long Voyage into this thing. And the reason I chose Greyjoy here is because it really this is the kind of deck that really taught everybody, I think, how much of a draw equals win the game really is. Because that's what Long Voyage does. It just has a huge draw box and then you get a draw. And this was a kind of very classic Greyjoy deck that haven't been making cuts or anything before that. But when you added in the draw engine, it suddenly just went berserk in a way. And there was nothing else to explain how much better that deck suddenly became than the draw. And sort of it just showed that having more cards just trumps every disadvantage an agenda can give.
TLV was very interesting to me because when it came out, people said it was rubbish. And so I wrote this big, long article on the maths of it and how you could optimize it and how it could be a very good deck. And then it definitely became. Like, this happened to be one of those cases where I was very, very right. And then as it was taking over the meta, I decided to take the opposite standpoint and say, look, here are some of the drawbacks of it that you guys were shouting about then, and here's how you can counter some of these things. At that point, people were just convinced that it was the devil's child and that it had to go. but it was definitely a very, very fun period. My last, so if we ended with another historical perspective, I finish it off with an extremely recent one. I'm going to go with the Baronneau Agenda that won Stalic 2014, that was the French deck that was played at Worlds 2014. This was an incredibly potent refinement. It was a very, very strong deck, and it's the second time that it was a deck that I had tested against, and the version that we wound up against was much, much stronger. So in 2013 at Gen Con, we had built our Greyjoy Black Sails. We knew Martel No Agenda existed. We tested against it. We beat it. The version they came with was so much better. Same thing here. Dave Stroms wound up playing against this Barra No Agenda. We were convinced we had a plus matchup. Turns out we were wrong. So even when you know the deck is out there, until you face it and you see what really good deck builders and really good players can refine it to, sometimes your gauntlet just isn't good enough. And this is the second deck to teach me that. It was a really, really efficient deck. It performed very, very well at two separate tournaments, even when people knew what it was doing. It was a mirror match final in the at Stalic, right?
I think so.
It was Donovan Van Beek versus La Plante.
Yeah, I think so.
So that I think that deserves credit. If you can make it to a mirror match in the final of the biggest Thrones tournament we've ever had, the deck has to be mentioned.
Yeah, it does.
And so are there any sort of notorious omissions, or now that we've talked about them, things you wished you'd said, or things you feel bad for leaving off?
Well, I love Bloodthirst, in a way, to an extent. I loved it once it got balanced out. I didn't love it initially. And I would have kind of loved to have an Bloodthirst here. Likely of a...
Alex Triggs?
Yeah, Trigs.
See, that was one of my regrets, was not having an Alex Trigg creation on my list. Yeah. So I agree with you there.
And if I really wanted it to be self-serving, I would have considered mentioning sort of one of my personal sort of favorite things ever to happen, at least myself, which
Stark
was...
Knight of the Hollow Hill?
Nope. Targaryen Knights, which I took to be second in Starlight Melee 1 year.
I should tell you a story about Targaryen Knights. At one point in testing for Gen Con this year, somebody broke out a Targaryen Knights. We all looked at the list. We said the deck was garbage, and it won the next 15 games in a row.
Yeah.
We still can't figure out why it did. We have no idea why this deck was beating the decks we were testing it against. And because we had no idea, we just couldn't refine it. We didn't know what it was that was working. And that's a really rare feeling for someone like me who likes to take apart decks down to the minute details, looking at the list and being, no, it's a terrible deck. It can't win. I will say that overall one of my regrets with the way this list works out, and it's always going to be the case, is that it has a tendency to acknowledge players who were first, a tendency to acknowledge the innovators, when sometimes the refiners are the ones that really made the list. Like I said, I think there was a phenomenal deck in House of Pain. I think the person who first added Bungled Orders, I have no idea who that is, was a genius, a deck-building genius.
Yeah,
but
I have to agree.
It's much harder to sort of acknowledge those stepwise differences when the base is already there. And a lot of those decks have. So that would be my regret about a top 10 list like this, is that it doesn't quite credit some of the people who were geniuses at these decks, but weren't the first.
Yeah. But thankfully, we also have a horrible name memory, so we can't even credit the ones who did win with them.
I think I had the name for every deck on my list.
Yeah, it was me and John, I think, who had the problems.
Good. That makes me look good by comparison.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Drakey, thank you for joining us. I have been mentioning on the cast in general and in comments that we've had a lot fewer European guests, and the reason, as we can tell with John leaving, is that it is becoming much, much harder for John and I to coordinate schedules across long distances. So I really appreciate you doing this with very short notice. You know, we told you what the idea was, and you said, I'll think about it. And then the next day I said, hey, are you available right now? And you were. So what is the most important thing, Lauren, that is happening this coming week?
That would be Thronestoberfest, Alex. Thronestoberfest is a traveling East Coast AGOT tournament. Last year it was in D.C., and the year before that it was in New York City, which my husband Britt won. That was our first competitive AGOT tournament, and he went to New York City and owned everybody. So hopefully some of those New Yorkers will come up to Boston to try to reclaim their title. So it's this coming Saturday.
Wow, you just throw down the challenges in Boston, eh?
Oh, yeah, that's how we roll.
Well, look, it's not a Beyond the Wall episode if it doesn't have controversy and throwdowns and everything
right,
else.
Right, of course. What was
last
I thinking?
Couple of episodes. Lord definitely has to say something very controversial in the closing.
Yeah.
So you're
think of,
are you
think
100%
of it, we'll
better than New York or just 90%?
I mean, you know, there is some variance because it's Thrones, but I'll say 90 most of the time.
So I haven't really looked into Thronestoberfest because it would be too tempting to me to then tell myself all the awesome stuff I'm missing. But I saw your prize support included.
Yeah, that's right. So because of the Oktoberfest theme of the tournament, every year there has been some sort of drinking vessel given out.
So wait, is it full or empty?
They can become full. They are currently empty.
You mean glasses can become full? This is not a very informative statement.
Yeah. I'm not feeling like that meant a lot.
Well, we usually go to the bar after our tournaments, so they'll probably end up full at some point.
Okay, but is Boston filling them or the person that won them filling them?
I don't know. Maybe we should issue some sort of challenge that, you know, the winner will get their beer filled, but not by me, because I plan to win, so...
All right.
Yeah, you don't want to fill your own beer, obviously.
Right.
Yeah, it's awkward. Yeah.
Right. So the other thing that we're doing that day is we've had a lot of interest in 2.0 from new players who are not 1.0 players. So we're also running a side event after the cut. That's going to be a 2.0 Swiss tournament. So anyone who doesn't make the cut can play, and as well as anyone who just wants to show up and play in the 2.0 tournament. So that'll be later in the afternoon.
So So then, and then they'll be joining you for drinks as well.
Of course. So we're really excited about that because it means that the new 2.0 players are going to show up to this 1.0 event, and everyone's going to get to meet for the first time in some cases and get to socialize, and they'll get to see how great of a game Game of Thrones is, you know, in its fullest form.
I really like that. It's, there's some symbolism there. There's some transition that I really appreciate of having the two events there at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're really excited.
So is that the most important thing to happen all week from the day this episode airs until that weekend?
I think I know what you're referring to, Alex, or I hope I do. Well, yeah, by the time we have Thronestoberfest, I'll have defended my PhD and I'll be a doctor.
So not only are you going to win Thronestoberfest, you'll be Dr. Fitch.
Everyone
I'll have to call you Dr. Fitch. That is going to be horrible. Very awkward. It's like when I talk to Alex, Dr.
No, you call her the Fitch that wins. Now it'll be Dr. the Fitch that wins.
Yeah, see, right. It's still confusing. Why do we have so many smart people?
People who went on to do a doctorate doesn't necessarily mean we were smart. Most of us, by the time we defend our thesis, realize it may not have been the ideal path.
And now we have Dr. Fitch.
Right.
Well, by the time people are listening to this, if they didn't listen to it too early, you'll be Dr. Fitch.
Yeah. Very exciting.
And if you're not, we're not editing this episode.
No. You're just going to feel bad every time someone calls you Dr. Fitch.
I'll feel really bad.
We have that much faith in you, Lauren.
I will mention, because I mentioned this earlier to Lauren, for my thesis defense, which wound up being a very enjoyable experience. It's not necessarily supposed to be. They're supposed to grill you, but you're the world expert in your field at that point, and they're grilling you about the document you wrote and your field, and it generally goes quite well. But before my thesis defense, I had a stress-induced bloody nose. I hadn't had a bleeding nose for like 7 years prior to that. And waiting outside the room to enter for my thesis defense, I was like, oh, crap, what is this? So it's still pretty nerve-wracking. Let's say that.
I'm going to try to avoid what happened to my lab mate at his last committee meeting, which was splitting the seat of his pants on his way in.
Well, for my defense, they forced me to wear those robes.
Really?
For your defense? Yeah.
Oh.
So splitting the seat of my pants would not have been...
I'm not going to get to wear wizard robes until graduation.
We had to wear wizard robes and get chained together. It was scary.
Get chained together so we could throw you all off a bridge?
Well, because they chain us all together and then have the chains wrapped around an anvil that they hit with a hammer anyways. It's complicated.
Are we still talking about Harry Potter or really just That's graduating from
really
engineering?
That's really what happens with engineering, yeah.
Sounds intense.
It's weird. Scary, visuals. Yeah.
Anyway, Thronestoberfest this weekend, if you're anywhere within, let's say, 500 miles.
Of Boston? Absolutely. And
maybe
we have
800 miles.
We have guest rooms galore for anyone that needs accommodations. If you want more information, you should check out our Facebook page. It's Thrones Boston, so you can search for that on Facebook and find us.
But if you left a comment in Beyond the Wall, I'm sure Lauren would check them and respond to you.
Oh yeah, because I'm on there all the time,
especially on Monday night.
That's it.
Yep.
Closing comments, John. What do you got for me?
Nothing.
You always have nothing for me. I'm very disappointed.
No, that's not true, Alex. If you're ever around and we're physically in the same room, I have a beer for you.
You have a beer for me? I ran out of beer. I'm drinking a glass of wine right now.
I have like 20 beer here right now because we're having Thanksgiving tomorrow. So
that's enough beer for you. You must not have very many guests.
We're bringing wine for the guests.
I see. Okay. Tournaments happening this weekend. There's both Thronestoberfest, which we were just talking about, but also in France, the Tournoi de la Main, the Tourney of the Hand, which is a big tournament. The prize is the white book. You get to you can't take pictures and post them online. You get to scribble in your sort of tourney report and your analysis of your opponents, and then it goes on to the next winner next year. This really neat little prize that they have in there. Obviously a great tournament. There's also obviously a ton of inaugural tournaments for 2.0, but yep. we can only mention the ones where people reached out to us because I cannot go looking for those. There's just way too many. But Scantrell in the Atlanta, Georgia area mentioned that there are two constructed tournaments, one on Sunday the 18th at Gigabytes, which will be Joust, and one on Sunday the 25th at Titan, which will be Melee. So if you're in Georgia, if you're in the Atlanta region, check those two tournaments out.
Yeah, and go support Scantrell because he actually does a lot for the community. So,
finally, I'd like to close off with a call for more volunteers. We mentioned a couple of times this episode now that we have some scheduling issues. It's getting a little bit harder to get these things rolling. And lots of people have reached out to us with ideas for content. We have a ton of ideas for content as 2.0 is working its way up. It's going to be fantastic. We'd love to have more volunteers to come talk about these things.
Yeah, right? We need people on the cast because though Alex and I are interesting folks, we're not that interesting together. I think it's Alex, actually. I'm just going to put it out there.
What? I'm boring?
Well, it's because you're a scientist and you like the numbers and the rules, and everyone knows that's boring.
Hmm. I should go back and look at the numbers of comments on this. I guess you have a point. yeah, so if you're available, if you're typically available to record over Skype, if you have a microphone, Skype connection, and you're interested in doing it at some point, add us to Skype. Or, you know, if you're available frequently after about 8:30 Eastern at short notice, our schedules are increasingly hectic. We'd love to have some more guest opportunities with some topics in mind. And even if you're a new player, the point is not to humiliate you or whatever. If you want to come on and ask us questions about the history of the game or why certain things are that way, or just, you know, build a deck together, we'd love to have some other people on.
Neither Alex nor I are going to Worlds, so we are happy to build 2.0, 1.0 tournament level decks with you on the show. If you don't mind, you know, everyone hearing what you're going to take, come on. We will give you all the information we can gather from the meta. You still there, Alex?
I am. I'm waiting for your snappy sign-off.
No.
Thank you for listening to Beyond the Wall. If you have any comments or would like to be featured on the cast, please let us know by email at beyondthewallpodcast@gmail.com or through Facebook at Beyond the Wall Podcast. If you've enjoyed the music, check out more of Antti Martikainen's work at the link embedded in the chapter data. See you all next week.
Antibiotic resistance.
Transference? Acquisition? Antibiotic resistance mechanisms?
There's this innate locus in E. coli that has been studied for a long time, so I'm going to start working on that. It's the Mar locus. So it's
just so you know that your science-y talk is starting to make me go crazy.
Oh, don't fall asleep.
Okay. E. coli can be fun to work on.
Well,
E. coli is lots of fun. All the tools already exist. All the knockouts already exist.
Yeah. Like, I work on TB right now, and it's just a giant pain.
TB, yeah. It takes you, what, 3 weeks to get a full culture? No, maybe two. Yeah.
3 weeks overnight. Like, what you would have an overnight in E. coli would be.
Three weeks. But you can do smegmatis overnight, right? You can do a lot of your work in smegmatis and then do tests in TB.